Blog Talk Radio.
Can even taste it. My name is Michael Banza.
Good morning, everyone. It's Saturday. It must be Blog Talk, the Cosmic Citizen. This is Paula Thompson coming to you from beautiful Colorado, where it's cloudy and a little cool today, but that's okay. We have a great topic today and a great guest, Ann Garner. Ann is from Dallas-Fort Worth area in Texas. Actually, Arlington, I think it is. How's it out there in Arlington, Ann?
Very wet, which we desperately needed in Texas.
Good. I'm glad to hear it. I know that the Austin area has been burning up.
Yes.
Anyway, today, friends, we're talking about interfaith dialogue, something very near to my heart, and I know very near to Anne's heart, too. I welcome all of our guests on in the chat room. Hi, everybody, all the listeners out there. Thank you for tuning in this morning. Our good friend Andre is in Washington, D.C., we'll just leave it that he's on business, but we know what a political person he is, so we'll...
Yeah, we'll leave that one alone.
Yeah, we'll leave that to everyone's imagination, and he'll be back with us next week, too, and I want to say a special hi to Kevin in Tokyo. Kevin, I hope you're out there. You wrote a beautiful prayer, and do you have his prayer by any chance?
I can sure find it, Paula.
I didn't open my email box because that's where it is. And oftentimes if I do that, then I get RAM problems. And I want the show to go off really smooth. So if you find that, I'll have you read Kevin's prayer.
We definitely want to affirm that. And by the way, I cannot get in the chat room yet. I do have this dinosaur computer, but that's okay. I can read what they're saying. Tell everybody hello,
and
have everybody affirm that we do have a wonderful broadcast.
We do, and you know, I think you guys, we need to take up a fund to get Anne a brand new computer so she can sit in the chat room and with us every week, because we always love hearing from you, Anne, and we love your, you know, Larry especially likes it when you jump in on the chat. So. You know, maybe a lot of our listeners don't know, but once you sign in to Blog Talk, you can join in the live chat. And although it does get challenging sometimes, technically, and you can also call in your show. And this is essentially an open phone show with Ann and I. We're talking about, obviously, about interfaith dialogue and the value of patient and loving interfaith dialogue. The Arantia book has a lot of interesting things to say about that. This show is exclusively about that and about the Arantia book. If you want to call in today, the guest call-in number is listed on your screen, but I'm going to give it to you anyway. It's 646-716-8158. Again, that's 646-716-8158. Did you find that prayer, Ann, by any chance?
Yes, I did. And
okay.
And the thing is, I can read the chat room, as you said. And remember, guys, they're saying something already. Larry's already teasing me about that computer that it's just pocket change for me.
She can read it. So
I can read it. Hi, Kevin. Hi, everybody. Yes, I found that beautiful prayer from Kevin, and I'd like to share that with our listening audience. Kevin has been reading only a few months. I think it's 4 or 5 months. Dear God.
Well, Kevin, before Ann reads your prayer, I just want to tell you that I remember my maiden voyage through the Urantia book. It's something I cherish more than anything, I think. I often tell people I hold it next to the birth of my children as a life-altering experience, and it really is that important to me, so I envy you your maiden voyage. God bless you on this voyage of discovery. It's quite a discovery you make when you start to read that book. So, okay, Anne, I'm ready if you're ready.
Yes. Dear God, I humbly come before you in your presence as a new reader of your words. I pray not so much for myself, but I have some friends I haven't even met in person yet, and they are the hosts and listeners of a radio show dedicated to the spreading of your teachings and your words and your love. I pray to you for the host of this show, and I pray that you just really show forth your spirit and your wisdom to them and guide and give them an even greater ability to be able to reach out to their guests each and every week so that they can do this very important work to share and to show others how they might also believe and be able to have a relationship with you also. I pray that the guests on the show each week can open their hearts and their minds and to really know deep down inside themselves by your spirit that they too can know your revelation and know you even deeper than they do already. And one more thing, if it's okay, please help me read this book and to really understand the difficult, hard parts. I ask this humbly from my heart that your will be done on the show each week, and sincerely in your name, in this we pray. Amen. And we all say amen and amen.
And even so may it be.
Yes. Now that was beautiful.
Thank you, Kevin. What a beautiful way to start the show.
And he did remind us that we and I know that each one of us pray in our own way, but it's always nice to start out with a prayer. I know Jesus had talked about the importance of prayer. Of course, most of his prayer was in silence. However, he did talk about the prayers of thanksgiving, right, that lead up to worship.
Right.
And that's important for all of us. We as Urantia book readers, we become fundamentalists in our own right, you know, because we take one part of the teachings and say, well, we're not supposed to pray out loud. So that's a great challenge for all of us. And that's what I love about this community. Uh-oh, Larry says my voice is too low.
Isn't it great, you guys? Anne can read your comments. I don't have to reiterate.
Oh, you can't read them today?
No, I can, but oftentimes because Andre can't see.
Oh,
I
yes.
read the chat board, and I try to pass along to him information that's being said on the chat board. So Anne is right with me right here with the chat board. She may not be able to type on it, but she can read it. So
yes, I'll keep trying to get in. What it is, my RAM on my computer, you know, it is an older computer, but it still serves quite well. It just struggles getting in, especially when there's quite a few people for some reason. But that's okay. Now, okay, I'm trying to see. Can you guys hear me? Test. This is a test. I'm rarely spoken of as my voice being too low. Being raised on a farm, you know, we had to speak pretty loudly to.
Well, and you know that's a good segue because. You were raised on a farm in the middle of the Bible Belt. Actually, not in the middle, but solidly in the Bible Belt. I think you said it was the Bible Buckle. Somebody told me that recently.
I did.
Anyway.
Yeah, one day I was thinking about that, and I went, I feel like I'm in the Buckle, you know.
Yeah, in the Buckle, yeah. In Mississippi, right? Was it Mississippi?
Right, Mississippi.
So we know that the beautiful South, very culturally solid in their own culture. And
absolutely, absolutely.
And, you know, so it's a marvel for me, Ann, to think how far you've come from that, excuse me, from that culturally to being essentially an interfaith minister and having deep spiritual experiences with people of all faiths and being willing to go and listen to them with your whole heart and not only just listen but learn their cultural experience, their faith experience, share on a very real and authentic level. And you know, you and I have had the wonderful experience, and we do have a caller online. Our dear friend Krislyn is waiting online. Christy, I just want to let you know I know you're there, and we'll patch you through in a minute. Ann and I have been to the Parliament of the World's Religions together. We worked shoulder to shoulder talking to religionists from all over the world. That first experience was in 1993. For us, the first Parliament of the Religion of the World's Religions was in 1993 at the Palmer House Hotel in beautiful downtown Chicago, Illinois. And interestingly enough, that Parliament was exactly 100 years later from the very first Parliament of the World's Religions that ever took place in modern times that anybody knows of, where the great Eastern traditions met with the Western traditions, and they met in that very hotel. And I'll never forget, Ann, when our good friend Peter Lawrence did a talk. It was about in 1990-91, I went to a Urantia gathering, and he was talking about interfaith. And he was telling us all about the Parliament and that they were planning this event and that it was going to happen and where it was going to happen. And I'll never forget what I did. I had a notebook and I was taking notes. And I wrote down, "We must be there." I underscored it three times and I put three exclamation points next to it.
Beautiful, beautiful.
And that was an affirmation for me, a validation that, man, when I heard him talk about this event, and he talked about how many of the 20th century religions made their debut at the Parliament, and I just knew that we must be there. And I focused all of my energy at that point on just making sure that happened. And as you know, you and I were both members of the Fellowship's Outreach Committee, good friends with Gard Jameson, who is a professor of comparative religions in Nevada. And he was going also. He was the chair of the Interfaith Committee. And it was a group effort. We took our booth there. We displayed our book. And for a solid week, we met with religionists from all over the world. And I don't want to hog the stage here because I know you have fond memories of this event. I've been at all the parliaments since then, and I vowed to the Heavenly Father that I won't miss one. If I can possibly be there at all, I'll be there. And I know you'd love to be there. Krislyn, I know you'd love to be there. You were in South Africa with me. But when we walked into the lobby of the Palmer House Hotel, you saw Sikhs and Muslims and Hindus and Franciscan friars. And it was literally walking into that beautiful lobby of that hotel, just glorious lobby. It was like walking into the world. And I don't recall ever having an opportunity to talk to people of all faiths. And the beautiful thing about it was they sent the cream of their crop. The religionists sent the cream of their crop. At least this is my estimation. And Ann and I had the most amazing and wonderful conversations for seven straight days. And we'd talk until the wee hours of the night and then get up and do it again. And we both decided that there's tremendous value in interfaith work. And Ann has been absolutely dedicated to interfaith work ever since. So, Ann, tell us a little bit about what you've been doing in interfaith since then.
Wow, a lot. And it's been on many levels. And I do want to step back to that experience with the Parliament of World Religions. It really felt like a Star Trek, you know, the Enterprise. Now, what was that other experience where they went to the planet? It wasn't Star Trek. It was they actually went into a bar and you saw all these creatures.
Oh yeah, that was Star
Somebody
Wars.
What was it?
Yeah, Star Wars.
Yes, Star Wars. Yes. And I know that's a strange thing to think of, but when I walked in and looked around. First of all, like you said, Peter started talking about it, and this began as just a small idea that began to blossom and grow. And I often have a saying about it, about something else we did also in Dallas to celebrate a year of Thanksgiving. We gave a party, and everybody came. And it really caught, everybody was like, oh, my goodness. In the beginning, they expected a few hundred. Maybe. Then they said, well, it looks like it'll be 1,000. I was reading my dear friend who's the executive director of Thanksgiving Square. I was reading her book, excerpts from her book recently. And according to her, it was 7,000 people there. Now, that's pretty amazing.
7,000 people.
Right.
And, oh, my gosh. And that was at the Parliament, Ann?
Yes.
Yeah.
In Chicago.
Yeah.
And I want to step back something you said about my own background. And I have often said this, if this can happen to me, I really believe it can happen to anyone on the planet, given the proper ability to be exposed to other experiences. If someone can't, you know, it's pretty, I can't speak that over them. And the way I was reared, everybody pretty much thought the same way. There was healthy, robust disagreement about the way, you know, as far as crops or whatever, but as far as just the religious ideas and as far as the community, everybody pretty much went to the same, had the same experience. And in that regard, it's easy to get along. You know, but even in the middle of that, do you think the churches in that community ever split on issues and had splits and divided up? Sure. And what a lot of people have asked me, and Paula, tell me if I've ever shared this with you. Why? What opened me up? Why was I able to move from a very small community where way out in the farmlands and then have an open mind toward people who speak differently and look differently than I. I don't know if I've ever shared that with you. If I have, I'll repeat it here.
I don't know. No.
Yeah. My father, who lived to be 94, woke up one morning, and I do not remember this, of course, but he woke up as a young man, suddenly paralyzed for no reason until he passed over. They never did really know what happened. They began to, the best that I ever heard was that actually some food he had eaten, you know, had done this. So all I ever knew was a man who didn't look like everybody else because there was a paralysis. And he didn't speak clearly. And I remember the first time I was consciously aware of it was when I went to school, and I was actually, it was three grades in one room, and my brother and I would be in the same room. He was 2 years ahead of me, and which turned out great because I could study what he was studying too. My dad came to pick me up one day to go to the closest town and for an appointment of some kind. And when he came to the door to pick me up, and I stood up to go with him, I heard these giggles, this mocking, and I turned around and I looked at these young people, these students. I think I was in the second grade or third grade, and I asked him, I said, what was that all about? He said, it's because I look different. and I don't talk the same. And all my work, the feelings that went through me, the humiliation and everything, I begin to see through my father's eyes. And for the rest of my life, that always stayed with me. And I remember just sitting there and praying in a childlike manner. I want to always be able to look beyond what somebody looks like.
Mm.
And I want to be able to hear what they're really saying. And I will tell you this, I cried so much. I disappeared the next day. I hid in the lunchroom. They couldn't find me for hours. And
wow.
Yes.
Because that had such an impact on you.
Well, and the next day there was mocking being done.
Oh of course, yeah. And children are cruel. And, you know, I think that people grow up and they overcome that kind of, you know, I mean, it's hard to teach children, you know, that lesson. I think children are just, I remember what it was like, you know, when kids in the schoolyard would bully other kids. And you know, you had the bully and you had the kid being bullied and you had the other kids who wouldn't say anything because they were afraid that the bully was going to turn on them and start to bully them. And I see that dynamic still, even in among adults, where, you know, the person who yells the loudest or is the most shrewdly eloquent speaker or whatever gets all the attention, and everybody else just kind of clams up and doesn't say anything because they don't want to be the next target.
I see that Kristen wants to say something about this, and I want to wrap this up and bring it on around how it affected me. That day that I disappeared and they couldn't find me for hours, and anyway, I got home and I was actually doing my chores, you know, on the farm, and was walking with my dad, and he was a man of very few words, and he could tell, of course, that I'd been crying, and I said, "Daddy, what am I going to do?" He said, "Don't feel sorry for me, feel sorry for them."
Oh,
I never forgot that. That, yeah. In other words, you know, just you're going to have to understand where they're coming from. And when Daddy was passing over in his last months, he asked me point blank, I was holding his hand, at 94 years old, he said, "Did we do a good job?" Now, here was a man who had already told me, "You deal with more changes in 1 year than I had to deal with in my entire life."
Wow.
And I remember I sat there and I held his hand. I said, "Yes, Daddy, you and Mom, you did a great job." He said, "I always wondered." I said, "Let me tell you what you did for me." And I shared with him what I just shared with you.
Uh-huh.
That you taught me how to see beyond. You taught me how to listen. And that's the reason I can hear accents from all over the planet and understand
people. You can understand people when they're speaking in a thick accent? Is that what you're saying?
Yes. Yes. He taught me how to listen intensely. So I just want to be very grateful for that experience. And who would have thought that would have led in years to come opening up to all these experiences?
I love to look back on my life and reflect on those lessons and how they bring you into this moment and where you are right now. I think that is of tremendous value. Let's put Kristalyn through, and I know I give a little background. Kristalyn was raised in a village in Africa, and she also is an interfaith minister. So, Christy, are you there?
Good morning.
Good morning.
Hi, Anne.
Hello. I'm enjoying the chat room, all the different fonts that everybody's coming up with.
Yeah, it only took me about a year and a half to figure out how to get my fonts to change.
So you know the topic. We're kind of exploring a little bit of quite a bit of what leads a person to want to know other people and want to understand other religionists in the most sincere sense. And clearly the Urantia book states that we should. It makes a very definitive statement, which I will find and read here in just a minute. But what's on your mind, Christy? I know you have a lot to add to this topic. Sorry, Crystalline. I know you probably prefer I call you Crystalline, so I'll try to remember that.
That's right. It's usually my closest family and close friends from my past who call me Christy, and I think you can qualify.
Okay. Thank you. It suits you for some reason.
Anyway, yeah, I was really moved by your story, Anne. And, you know, I had some similar kinds of experiences when I was young, having grown up in another culture, which, frankly, I mean, for me was my culture of origin because it was all I knew as a small child. But in reflecting now, I can see how all of that was really preparing me for my interfaith interest and sensitivity, because I lived in this really little village where I was, you know, very well loved and taken care of and by, you know, sort of the whole village. And it was a really almost an idyllic experience in many ways. And then at a fairly early age, I went off to boarding school, which was in the capital city, and where I lived at a boarding house with all these other missionary kids. And then I went to an international school where there were more than 38 countries represented in a school of less than 1,000 students, K through 12. And I didn't realize what a, you know, unique experience that was, how profoundly that affected my entire world view. But it did. And when I moved to this, I had very idealistic images of the United States and what it stood for. And I was pretty shocked when I moved here. I moved to the Midwest and found that America wasn't anything like what I was expecting it to be. I was sort of appalled at the time at the lack of interest in other people in the rest of the world and in different ways people thought and different ways people experienced the world, because I found that so passionately interesting. And so I can relate to a lot of what some of the guest speakers were talking about last week, one in particular who had been raised a Muslim and who felt that until people of all different faiths and creeds and backgrounds have an opportunity to learn new ways of thinking or other ways of thinking, We're going to be sort of stuck in our cultural fundamentalism.
Culture fundamentalism. Yeah.
I think that exists in many parts of the world. I mean, although I agree with you, Crystalline, that a lot of times Americans go to other parts of the world and expect the rest of the world to be just like it is in America and get upset if it's not, you know. I think the term has been called ugly American, and I've talked to people who have traveled or lived in other parts of the world, and they've noticed that, you know, that sometimes that does happen, where we go over there and expect that everything to be just like it is here. It's a different part of the world. It's a different culture.
But almost all Americans who have lived overseas for any period of time, when they come back, they are transformed by that experience. And it's the insulation or the insular nature of culture that I think is fundamentalism producing.
Mm.
And when you get exposed to others in an intimate way outside of your culture, you can't help but love them. And I think one of the things we've all experienced at the Parliament of World Religions is the incredible camaraderie that we experience almost instantly with these other religionists, regardless of what faith tradition they come from. But also to realize that those that we encounter in the interfaith movement are the often the exception, not necessarily the rule. They're the ones who are sort of the adventurous ones. They're the truth seekers, the people who really do manifest the fruits of the Spirit in their lives. And while many people profess to be religious, there are many motivations for getting there that have nothing to do with a real intense desire to know and do the will of the Father in heaven. And Larry has said on the board, you know, every culture thinks that they're exceptional. And
right. And that's fair. You know, that's fair overall. Because by that I mean, I have a cartoon I'm going to share with you. It's hard to explain a cartoon, but I'm sitting here looking at it, and I've kept it for years and years and years. It's a room full of small children. And it's a young girl dancing, you know, like a ballerina. She thinks in her, you know how the little bubble, somebody made me think of it because Brother Dave asked, what's the name of an old cartoon character? Something that he asked. And the little bubbles up above, in her little bubble, she thinks she's dancing like a flower, right? All the other children in the room, all their bubbles are different. Horses, cats, lions, tigers, octopus, tree. That little cartoon is very comical and humorous and also reality, that most people really think that their dance is and their culture and their experiences, they're valid and they're real. But we have to be careful that we don't try to superimpose those on others. Does that make sense?
Well, it makes complete sense, and I think that, you know, the Arantxa book is so practical in this way. You know, it's, as we all know, it's not just a religious book, and nor is it, you know, it integrates science, religion, and philosophy, and it gives us very practical ways to know our fellows, to understand them, to fall in love with them. It tells us the way to world peace. It says things like trade will do more to create world peace than all of the sentimental peacemaking sophistries. That's a real interesting statement. It says that one language creates a real barrier to getting to know your fellows. Therefore, it keeps peace at bay. It says the ability to travel will really help promote peace. And I think it's for all the reasons we're just talking about right now. It's so easy to misunderstand and then foment misunderstanding when you don't really know who and what you're talking about. And you know, I love to point out to people that Jesus said, by their fruits you will know them. He did not say by their culture, by the country they live in, or the religion they profess to follow, or what the book they say they read, or the color of their skin, or the class that they belong to. He didn't say that we would know each other by any of those superficial means, but that we would know each other by our fruits. And so what comes to me about that is, if you want to know somebody, you have to spend some time with them. I can't tell if a person is kind or loving, or loyal, or trustworthy, or patient, in an instant. I have to spend time with that person to get to know their fruits. And I think in a way that's what he was saying. Get to know your fellows. And obviously that's a theme that's reiterated by the book. And there's the challenge. He threw the gauntlet down. Get to know them. So now how do we do that? We know that he was deeply interested in people. He spoke, what, 5 languages? He would go down to the crossroads and meet the caravans as they came through, speak to people from all over the world. He was deeply interested in people, in how they made a living, what they did, who they were. It says things like, he helped people more by listening to them than by anything he said. In fact, it says, to those he helped the most, he said the least.
I always like that quote, to those, yep. And Paula, you asked earlier about all what type of experiences I've had. And it's interesting, I've said this before on the broadcast, doing the Whole Life Expos, being asked by you and Mo to do those, began to open me up in a way I'd never expected. I'd already had some experiences, but I made a determined decision, even in the 80s, when I was, that sounds funny, in the 80s, way back in the 80s. I never thought that would sound strange to say that, but reading the papers, the book, when I came across Symbioten's paper. Now, for new readers, we need to tell them where that is. And Symbioten was where Jesus went in his before he went into public life, and it was a group of religious people from all walks of life that made an agreement.
The original Interfaith College, right?
Right. And that's paper 134, I think, the Urmia Lectures.
The Urmia Lectures, right. Symbioten was the man who ran the lectures, right?
Right. And I remember reading that, and now that comes on at the end of Jesus' private life. By that I mean, you know, he was so well known. And in those papers, I said, wow, I have really led a sheltered life religiously. I want to get to know my fellow man, my fellow woman. So I began to pray. And within weeks, people, I don't know if they were already there. It may be sort of like you decide to buy a yellow car and suddenly there are yellow cars everywhere. I don't know what came first. But suddenly people began to appear in my life that were of different religions. And instead I said, I'm going to get to know them. Well, through the years, one-on-one, I began to know these people. Well, that expanded into going into their religious settings. Now, that's a huge jump from meeting someone casually in a store or getting to know someone at work, and then you walk inside their religious environment. And I am so grateful that I went ahead and made that leap of faith and to walk in and say, okay. And I can remember walking in my first time, for example, with the Sikhs. And, you know, I've really I enjoy worshiping with them. And sitting there, in my first few minutes, I was like, oh, my goodness, this is uncomfortable. I'm not used to this music. And I said, I'm already judging. Out of pursuing that and going back, it ended up that out of that experience and being with the Buddhist monks, where I learned how to meditate and really, really go into a deep place of meditation, that personal, ongoing, walking in their shoes, getting on the other side and looking back toward myself is when I really begin to modify my thinking and my behavior patterns. Does that make sense?
Totally.
Yeah. And now, there's robust dialogue in those settings, and this is something people need to understand. You don't always agree. There are times that you do, it's not idealist. You know, people think, everything will be hunky-dory. No. There's great challenges and robust challenges. And Thanksgiving Square is more of a formal setting where we come together quite frequently to have open dialogue. We have projects together, and we have our formal meetings once a month. I've been on that panel since that council since 1995. And we've had a lot of tension. But the model has always been underneath and above, you might say, of, okay, we're here to find mutual respect. We cannot believe the same. And that's where I, as a Urantia Book reader, I came to an understanding. I'm not here, I am known as a Urantia Book reader, but I'm not here to try to convince these people to read the book. That's a huge lesson for me, because there was a time in my life that I thought, oh, I'm here to get everybody I meet to read the Urantia Book. And that's fine if people want to do that. But for me, I came to a place for myself of a deeper understanding within myself that it's the religion of Jesus to look it upon them, and the golden rule, do unto others as you would have them do unto you, which is found in all religions. I'm sure everybody has seen that by now.
You know, I think that you bring up such a good point. And, you know, oftentimes engaging in interfaith dialogue, we're looking for, and this has happened to me many times. I know it's happened to you. I know it's happened to Kristalyn, because we've all done outreach and we've all reached out and talked to people of all faiths and people of fundamental faiths. And they'll ask you a series of questions until they can find the one thing that we disagree on. And then they get all hung up on that. And it's almost like they're looking for the disqualifier. They're looking for the thing that disqualifies you. Well, what does it say about this? Well, what does it say about that? Well, what do you believe about that? Well, what about that? And they'll go down the list, and then when they find the one thing that, there it is, I don't agree. No, if you believe that, no. You're going to hell, or I don't know, take your any number of bad, horrible consequences because you don't agree with that. And I think that's where the rubber meets the road. That's where the conversation gets really interesting, and where you're called to dig down really deep. It's easy to talk to people who completely agree with you religiously. Even as challenging as it is to sit in study group and disagree with your Urantia Book readers, sometimes it's we're fundamentally coming from the same point of view, because we all agree this thing is an amazing revelation of truth. But we have our disagreements of interpretation. But when you come down to a really fundamental disagreement about the nature of God, for instance, that's when the conversation gets interesting, and when you really have to dig down to find the spirit of the teaching and the spirit of truth. It's like Jesus, you know, he was the perfect example of somebody who was able to do this when he was talking to Gadiah about Jonah and the whale. He
now
could
you
easily
might,
have said,
that for new readers, Paula, where is that? That was in his private life.
Again, yeah, in his private ministry. The years before he found his apostles and began his public ministry, and he met a young man who was sincerely interested in that story of Jonah and the whale. Now, Jesus could have said to him, oh, look, that's a fairy story, a made-up story. But he didn't. He built on the truths of that story for this young man's sake. And his philosophy, Jesus' philosophy, was never take anything away. Build on it. Build on that foundation of truth. And we know that the Urantia Book does that. It builds on the foundations of Judeo-Christianity. It builds on the foundations of monotheism. It has many splendid, wonderful, solid foundations in our own religious culture. If it came to us from another, you know, and built on the foundations of another world's religious culture, it wouldn't mean anything to us. It builds on our own foundations, the foundations, the constructs that we've created. And I think that's the trick to interfaith dialogue. So I would like to ask you both, because I know you've had some wonderful conversations. Does one stand out where you just were really stumped by a question or an interaction, and you had to dig down deep and find that common ground where you could move past that?
Oh, sure. For me, it's always been the atonement doctrine, and to find a way of finding a common ground of dealing with that. And that continues to be challenging for me. It came up this week. I was sitting with a young lady who, and we probably interacted for over 2 hours just 3 days ago. She was raised in a communist country as an atheist, and it was fascinating to me to hear her process of deciding which religion to go with. And I will tell you that the thing that she began to study Christianity, and the concept of the atonement doctrine and the concept of a burning hell was so repulsive to her that she turned away and went toward a whole nother faith. Now, and I'm not even going to say which faith she's in, because it's not germane to this conversation. As far as which one did she go to, there are things in that religion she doesn't necessarily agree with. But at one point she said, "So Anne, how do you feel about this thing about Jesus and about the atonement?" So I'd explained the difference between the religion of Jesus versus the religion about Jesus, and I explained my understanding of that there is no burning hell, that didn't make sense. But she turned, and she just suddenly turned. She said, if I'd heard that, the religion of Jesus versus the religion about Jesus, I could very well follow that particular religion. Now, that was just 3 days ago. And we need to get to that place. Or do they always come out that bright and shining and good? No. There are those that have come to me and with the intent on of trying to trick me, you know? Well, that's a no-win situation. And it takes people that have never been in interfaith, never been involved. It's interesting to sit there being known as your Rancho Book reader. Because we are the new kids on the block, you know.
They don't know quite what to think of us sometimes, I think.
Right, right. And I that's why I always love the chat room, because we'll have visitors, and I always enjoy reading. Well, what do we look like to them? And just 2 weeks ago, there was an interesting dialogue in the chat room. I think that would have been, August 29th? I went back and reread that, and it was just fascinating to me. I never get tired of that, of what, and we all need to be aware of that. What do we look like? It's sort of like in my own bloodline. Yeah, we'd all disagree and blah, 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 but in the end, we as a family would say, yeah, but we need to stand together and not have so much infighting. Of course, that doesn't always pan out.
No, it doesn't, but I think you're bringing up some really good, some of the things that are really challenging. Lou on the board just said, you know, here are some of the things that Christianity has an issue with: the atonement doctrine, the virgin birth, Jesus being the second person of Trinity. These are all doctrines or beliefs, and as we know, the Urantia book says beliefs can be fixating, but faith is liberating. Crystalyn, do you have a story you want to share about an interfaith dialogue you've had where you've kind of had a breakthrough?
Well, I actually can't think of anything at the moment that really is an exact response to that question, but I have had some experiences that have been very unique, unusual, and what tend to stand out for me are the times where I behave very out of character for myself.
Mm.
You know, I tend to speak my mind quite quickly and think on my feet very, very fast. And so I frequently speak without thinking, with sort of a confidence that what I say is going to work out somehow. I frequently have no idea what I'm talking about. But I had a situation once at following the Parliament of World Religions where someone asked me what that book was sitting on my mantelpiece. And, you know, could he borrow it on his vacation? And he was a very highly highly placed in the hierarchy of his religious system. He was would have been like the equivalent probably of a cardinal in Catholicism.
Wow.
And I was afraid to answer the question, which was very unusual for me. I was, because I was raised with the Urantia book, I'm a second generation reader, I've always been very comfortable talking to people about it. I've never felt the kind of, you know, resistance that a lot of people feel. And I've also sort of, I don't argue about religion. You know, I won't argue with people about it usually. I like to discuss religion with people. I might argue about politics or I might argue about other things, but I try not to ever argue about religion. But I did feel a bit frightened that this person was someone who, if I said the wrong thing, could kick me out of where I was staying. And I had recently had an experience with a family member overseas who is a minister, who when they found out I was a Urantia book reader, they were they almost kicked me out of their house. And so I was nervous. And so I said almost nothing. And Paula, you know how unusual that is for me. So
yeah.
I just said, well, sure, you're welcome to borrow it. I was totally noncommittal. And I said, you know, I sort of described it in very dispassionate terms. And he came back and was just on fire with it. He's like, this is the Jesus that I know. I mean, and, you know, it was sort of like I was bowled over. The power of the book to, you know, to speak for itself. And that was a very life-changing experience for me.
What when he came back, didn't he come back from his little trip and he was absolutely blown away by the story?
He wanted all of the Urantia books I could possibly get for him.
Yeah.
Because he wanted to give them to all the other clergy that he worked with. And you know, so it was a very powerful experience for me in learning when to shut up. So I don't know if that's quite exactly the same kind of thing you're talking about. But
no, I think
good.
I think that's perfect. And I want to share the spirit of a dear friend of ours who taught me a lot about this very thing, about listening. And it wasn't for the Parliament, interestingly enough. It was and I know you both have had experience with outreach. When you go out to talk to anybody of any faith, even if you have a background in Christianity or if you have a background in Hinduism, it doesn't matter what your own culture is. Anytime you reach out to have a dialogue with anybody about their beliefs, you're on tricky ground, very tricky. And just like you said, Crystalline, you got kicked out. Wasn't it a family member who got so angry at you? You know, we've all experienced that with the Urantia book. I mean, we in one way or another, had people think we're crazy because we read this book that doesn't have a quote-unquote human author attached to it and things like that. And, you know, you have the difficulty, and it's difficult at best to breach that topic with somebody, the topic of religion. In fact, I grew up hearing that was one thing you never talked about to anybody was religion. And to me it was funny because it's the one thing I always wanted to talk about the most.
And I think most people like to talk about religion, but it really is tricky ground. And when we started working the expos, our dear friend Dwayne Faugh, General Dwayne Faugh, wrote a little paper for me, and it's called Techniques for Responding by Dwayne Faugh. And it's short enough. I hope you guys will indulge me, because this has always helped me tremendously, and I think you'll remember this well. We used to do a training meeting before every expo, and this was one of the things we covered with folks. Techniques for responding. 1, look for the good, correct, spiritually true, and emphasize it. 2, beware of the bad, erroneous, spiritually false, and A, ignore it. B, de-emphasize it. C, confess problems with it. D, find a superior concept and raise it as a question. 3, beware of those contentious individuals who seek to dispute with you. If the motive for the query is suspect, you can ask them, why do you wish to know? Are you sincerely interested in considering my views? I promise to consider your point of view. Will you promise to consider mine? 4, do not be judgmental or condemning. Never paint the other person into a corner. Leave them a graceful way out. Oh, I love this one so much. This one comes to me. Am I leaving this person a graceful way out? Am I backing them into a corner? Oh, man, it's so important.
Say that again.
He says, 4, do not be judgmental or condemning. Never paint the other person into a corner. Leave them a graceful way out. And then he gives examples. He says, A, speaking only for myself as I see it, .. B, I cannot personally accept that, .. And C, in my experience, I have always found that, .. See how beautiful that is, because you're speaking from your own perspective. You're not...
Well, he was one of the best at that.
He's such a diplomat. I mean, this guy was a brigadier general. You know, he had to talk... I mean, he served in 3 wars. He served in World War II, Korea, and Vietnam. He had to talk to people from all cultures. He was a true, true diplomat.
Is anywhere on the web, Paula, for folks?
I will.
Yeah, I'd love to have a copy of that.
Okay, there's a couple things, actually, that we always shared. One was The Art of Creative Listening, which is also a very good document, too long to share here, obviously. It's by Paul J. Meyer, but it's How to Listen Creatively. And this one, Techniques for Responding by Dwayne. Okay, so 5, he says, when someone gets personal, judgmental, or insulting, turn to Jesus. A, I believe that it is not right for us to judge each other. Judge not, lest ye be judged. B, if you knew me, you would know that I try hard to be a good person. You shall know them by their fruits. Again, Jesus. And C, I only share my truth with respect, and I equally respect your beliefs. And then Jesus again, forbid him not. He who is not against us is for us. And then the 6th point he makes is, and this is the last one, very simple document. I will publish this on the web for everybody's edification. It's always been tremendously helpful to me. 6, in case of an irrevocable conflict, retreat gracefully and with dignity. A, I am confident you believe what you are saying as sincerely as I believe what I say. B, you have a right to your opinion and I to mine, so let's leave it at that. And C, thank you for your interest in my soul. Please believe that I have a similar interest in yours. Now, that to me, that
those little techniques for responding, and he gives you perfect examples, things you can say. And when you're out there, when you step out to deal with people of other faiths, and you're talking about the Urantia book, or you're dealing with interfaithers, or you're at an expo and you're wanting to introduce people to the concepts of the book, and you're talking one on one with somebody, these are very, very powerful tools to have and to remember. And it really does give you a way. And I've had conflicts like this last one. In case of a irreconcilable conflict, I wanted to share something with you, a personal story of mine where we were at an expo, and I know you guys have probably experienced this, where there was a group of fundamentalists who came up and literally consumed our booth. There was probably four of us there. And there was four of them, and each one of them engaged us in a, you know, kind of a deadlock kind of conversation. They would not give us a graceful way out. And what was unfortunate about that was there was other people who came up to the booth who wanted to talk to us but couldn't, and I think that was somewhat of a ploy on their part. And they came back several times during the course of the evening and did the same thing. And they came just to contend. And by that time, I had these in my heart pretty solidly, these techniques for responding by Dwayne Faw. I had incorporated them many times. That's the other point I wanted to make, practice. And you touched on this. You got to practice this. There's no way that you're going to go out and talk to other religionists and be good at it right off the bat. You really have to go out and try it, make mistakes, and get better at it. But it has so much value once you really feel comfortable with it and you feel like you can do it. It's something you never regret having learned how to do. And
although I'd like to just interject really briefly. I think that there is a way that you can do it without fear right away, without a lot of practice and without a lot of skills. And that is to be just genuinely and sincerely interested in your in the other person's personal religious experience.
It's like our good friend Jennifer says, be interested and interesting.
Well, and you don't have to focus on being interesting if you're really interested.
That's true. If you're interested, you're interesting.
And the way to be interested, if you don't know how to be really interested in other people, is, you know, to see it like a research project, you know, that you are, like Jesus did. I mean, he traveled as far as he could around the world to meet as many different people as he could, to learn about them, to learn how they made a living, what their families were like. What they thought, what their personal experiences were like, what were the most, you know, what were they passionate about? And you can do that with anyone at any time. It doesn't have to just be about religion, but when you treat other people with that level of interest, they can feel your sincerity because it's palpable. And I want to just really quickly share, my mother was talking, I may have talked about this on the air recently, but my mom was talking to one of her colleagues at work once, and she wanted to know why my mom had so much success with her clients. She worked for the Handicapped Children's Department for the State Health Department. And my mom said, well, you have to be sincere. And the other colleague says, well, how do you act sincere? And I just thought that was a great, great line, you know. Well, you can't act sincere. You can only be sincere.
One of my quick quotes on that is from Zig Ziglar, who was a great sales guru and a great person, I think, a lot like the one that wrote How to Win Friends and Influence People. Who was that again? Gosh, I'm having a senior moment, friends. I'm sorry. Another great sales guru, anyway.
Okay, guys in the chat room.
How to Win Friends and Influence People. But Zig Ziglar was in that same vein, and he said, He said, people don't care how much you know until they know how much you care.
Right.
And for me, that is just, I hold that one in my heart. Communicate first how much you care. And then people will care how much you know. And I think that's what we've been saying in a way, that we listen, we are interested. And because we're interested, you know, it's like the book saying that Jesus helped those the most that he said the least to. He just listened, and it says that he allowed these troubled mortals to just bare their souls. Okay, Lou got it. Thank you.
Yay! No, Larry got it. Larry got it. Dale Carnegie.
Dale Carnegie.
Yeah. We got it too. Okay. So who wins? Right. Okay. We're playing.
Who wins? So
Larry,
you know,
for the win.
Let me finish my story real quick.
Yeah, I'm sorry, but they came in at the same time, so we'll call it a tie.
Okay. We'll have to think of something to send one of those guys, or both of them, maybe.
Yeah, I'm fine. I apologize. Go ahead.
No, I was standing at the booth having this wonderful conversation with a fundamentalist, a fundamental Christian, and he was just hammering me. I mean, he would not leave me a graceful way out at all. And I kept trying, and the harder he tried to get me flustered, the more I was determined to be calm and peaceful and loving to him. And the way I've learned to look at it is, how many times do you have opportunities to be truly like your master, you know? It's easy to be nice to people who are being nice to you. It's not easy to be nice to people who aren't being nice to you. And that's where you really get to practice what you preach. And so I was determined to be as kind and loving to this man as I could be. And he kept going on about everywhere where I was wrong and totally off base. And finally I said to him, I said, you know, Jesus said that we would know each other by their fruits. And I said exactly what I said earlier at the beginning of the show. I said, you don't really know me. You can't know me. You don't know if I'm patient. You'd have to spend some time with me to know that. You don't know if I'm tolerant. You'd have to see me in a lot of different life situations to know that about me. You can't know that if I'm loving or peaceful. And he stopped me short and he said, well, I do know you're patient. And he said, mine's really big. And I said, how do you know I'm patient? He said, because I have thrown everything I can think of at you to fluster you, and you have not gotten flustered. You've been incredibly patient with me.
Wow.
And what was so powerful about this was at that very moment, the ice between us completely melted away. And we started talking, and we had a real dialogue. We started talking about everything we love about Jesus and about our lives. And by the time we were done having that wonderful exchange where we exchanged heart to heart, brother to sister, we hugged each other really big. And he walked away different, and so did I. We were both enriched by the exchange. It didn't end where there was any bad feeling at all. There was nothing but love between us. And I felt like that was a great moral victory for me, because I chose to walk the walk. I chose I chose to return good, right?
And that's not easy, and it's not simple.
No, it's not. But again, I would reiterate to folks in the moment, and this is, you know, probably another whole topic, but you can invite God into the moment. In fact, that's when you should invite him. Crystal,
well, Kevin is quoting something I'd quoted to him on the board. He had a situation that was very difficult. and someone actually quoted, if your own mind does not serve you well, you can exchange it for the mind of Jesus. I don't think that's a direct quote. I'm reading it. Lou, is that a direct quote? I believe it. Y'all know where that is. See, I still read the older version of the book. I know it's on the right-hand page at the bottom. That's all I know.
Well, exchange it for the mind of Jesus. It will
serve
never
serve you well. Yeah.
It will serve you well. And, you know, I think, and I have several stories along those lines where I've been deadlocked into a conversation with somebody, and I've prayed, you know, where it was kind of going nowhere, and I've prayed, Father, give me the words. And
mm-hmm.
I take Jesus at his promise when he says, fear not, for in that hour my Father will speak through you. My Father will speak through you. And I often just quickly say, okay, Master, you promised.
Get ready. I'm about to let you in.
Give me the words. Give me the words here. And so I can transmute this situation into something beautiful and positive and not something negative. And honestly, it works every single time I invoke it, every single time. And that one that you just said, Anne, that you gave Kevin, ask for the mind of Christ, for it will never fail you. If your mind should fail you, ask for the mind of Christ. And, you know, and I know, Krislyn, you have an amazing story. It's a favorite of mine, and maybe I can get you to share it.
Maybe not.
About this very thing. Where you were in a real dangerous situation and you asked for help and God.
Well, I won't go into a lot of detail, but I'll just say that I had an experience once where I'm not absolutely certain that my life was in jeopardy, but I know for certain that my honor was.
Wow.
And I was afraid, and I very rarely am afraid of other human beings. But I felt really seriously outnumbered, and I knew that I could not defend myself with my wit or with my physical, you know, aggressiveness. I was sunk. And I didn't have very much time. So all I had time to pray was, help me. Help me. And it was definitely a sincere prayer. I really needed help.
Okay, and are you going to set it up, the situation? You were crossing a dark alley all by yourself, a young, beautiful woman, and you passed a whole biker gang, a gang of motorcycle outlaws, right? They were all standing in the alley looking at you with who knows what they were thinking. So anyway, that's what happened right when you said this little prayer, help me.
Well, and
you were all by yourself, right?
I was by myself, and it was dark. It was getting dark, and I was in a very bad part of a very bad city, in a really dangerous part of town alone. And I had gotten there sort of quite innocently but foolishly. And so I prayed for help, and instantly I found myself walking towards the largest and the meanest looking guy in the group. I must have assumed he was the leader of the group, but I can honestly tell you I don't remember thinking anything. My mind was blank. But I found myself walking up to him and smiling and putting my hand on his shoulder and looking up into his eyes and saying, boy, am I glad to see you guys. I need your help. You know, I'm a bit lost. I know I shouldn't be out here alone. Would you walk me to my car? And I was shocked at what came out of my mouth. I have no idea that was what I was going to say. Nor would I have ever thought of saying that. It was one of the first times in my life that I remember being really where I felt God had really intervened in my life. And
I love it.
It was a, pardon me?
I love that story.
What happened, Crystalline?
Yeah.
Well, they transformed before my eyes. Physically, they transformed. This guy who had this look of menace and malintent and I can't say hatred, but you know, definitely less than benevolent intentions. I saw him change. He stood up and his chest puffed out and he raised his head and he looked around at the other guys. He said, sure, we can do that. We'd be happy to help you, you know. And they all became these like gentlemen before my very eyes. And they walked me to my car. And
they were also a different ethnicity from you, right? I mean, they were...
Right, and that was the part that was really inspiring to me in a way, mind-changing for me. The back story for this was I had been in a black section of town where I felt perfectly safe because I grew up being the only white kid in town or white girl in town. And I felt no trepidation being in this black ghetto alone. But I had changed, I had moved out of the black part of town and into the Hispanic side of town. And these guys were Hispanic and they were leering at me in Spanish. I couldn't understand them, but I could tell from their gestures what they meant. I mean, there was no doubt in my mind what they were, you know, implying and what their intentions were. I was terrified of them because I didn't understand them. And I thought I was ashamed of myself at the same time of being afraid because I knew I felt prejudice. I felt some bigotry because I didn't understand these kinds of people. And I thought that was ironic because, you know, I sort of had a certain amount of sort of self-righteous attitude there, you know, like, well, I'm not bigoted. I'm not prejudiced. I'm not in danger of having those kinds of human feelings. But I did because I didn't understand this particular culture.
And
yeah, it was very complex. And I didn't understand the language. And like Anne, I also grew up able to understand almost anyone trying to speak English.
I remember something I read. So you sought to understand. You sought the higher plane of interacting, and that's happened to me in the past, a long time ago, even before I'd ever found the Urantia book. But I remember reading this in a book, and it's a paraphrase: the consequences of not knowing our neighbors creates a climate of mutual ignorance.
Wow.
That can foster misunderstanding and breed mistrust. That's a powerful statement. And I read it somewhere this week, and I know I'm paraphrasing it, but think about that. Mutual ignorance.
Mm-hmm.
And that fosters misunderstanding and breeds mistrust.
And even when you don't speak the language or, you know, obviously, Crystalline, they did speak your language because when you went up and asked them for help, they graciously offered to help you. And I think you used a classic Jesusonian technique, and that was obviously God worked through you in that moment, and he elicited the best in them. And the Urantia book tells us that Jesus was obviously the master at that, to draw out the best in human beings and to see the best in them. And because he saw the best in them, they became their best for him. And I think that that's exactly what happened in that situation. when you cross the alley. And to me, that's inspiring. And I've heard, oh, man, I've heard some amazing stories about people who invited God in the moment and some of the things that that have happened as a result. I remember a great story from our friend Jerry Johnson, who said she was at home meditating one day in a very, very deep place of peace, very deep place of peace. And she just came out of the meditation, looked up, and saw a man standing over her, a stranger, a complete stranger in her house, in her home, looking down at her. And he had that same look of menacing, you know, and maybe they surprised each other. She later said she thought he was probably there to burglarize her home, didn't know she was there, but found her there in lotus position on the floor meditating and was just standing over her with this threatening, menacing stance. And she looked up at him in this place of deep peace and she said, "You can hurt my body, but you can never harm my spirit." And she said at the moment she said that, this man just collapsed in a heap on the floor and cried like a baby. And she took his hands. This is what's so incredible about this story. She took his hands and she said, "Will you pray with me?" And he said, "Yes." And she said they sat there on the floor together praying for God, you know, to work in their lives. And praying for goodness and truth and beauty and peace and understanding and acceptance and you know, morality and all of the good things. And she said it changed this, it literally changed this man's life. She will never know what he intended to do. But whatever happened after she invited God in the moment and used that powerful word, "You can harm my body, but you can never hurt my spirit." Whatever was in those words changed this guy, and it changed the whole situation. It transmuted it. And by the time they were done, he said to her, "You don't know me, and you don't have to help me, and I wouldn't blame you if you didn't. I wouldn't blame you if you hated me, but," he said, "I have to do something, and I need your help." And she said, "I swallowed real hard and said, okay, what do you need me to do?" He said, "I want to leave something with you. And let these people come and pick it up." And he said, "You know, you don't have to do it. I understand. And I don't blame you if you didn't trust me, but please, will you help me in this way?" And she said she was really hesitant because she didn't know what it was about. But she said, "Okay, I will help you." So the next day he brought a big box over to her house. And he told her, "I have told them to contact you and come and get this. They know you had nothing to do with this, and I have instructed them that you had nothing to do with it, that you are a kind and good person, and you're just willing to help." And so these people showed up at her house the next day to get this box. She didn't know what was in the box. And they showed up at the front door, and they knocked on the door, and the man immediately started saying, "How do you know this guy, blah, 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 what do you know?" And the wife corrected him. She stopped him. She said, "He told us she knows nothing. She's just a good person. She's willing to serve us in this way, and so don't ask her any questions. We promised we wouldn't." And he said, "She has nothing to do with any of this. She's just a good person." So the man stopped, and they came in the house, and they opened the box, and inside the box was all of their personal effects that this man had stolen from their house, a hand-carved chess set and beautiful things that meant a lot to them, obviously. And they were so grateful to her for being willing to hold on to this and allow them to come and pick it up. And in this way, the man, the burglar, made amends, at least maybe in his own heart and mind, he made amends, and he turned a corner. And all of this because she let God into the moment and in that moment of peace and power. And she said she never saw the man before nor since. Except two weeks after that event, she was walking down the street, and he was approaching her in a wonderful, he was all dressed up, he had a suit on, and she stopped for a moment, they stopped with each other on the street, and she said, "You look really nice, where are you going?" And he smiled really big, and he told her, "I'm going to get a job." And that was the, you know, so that's the
wow.
whole. But it's just such a, it just shows that if you pause in that moment, whether you're in an interfaith dialogue or a conflict with a family member, you can stop in that moment and pray for the mind of Jesus, or you can ask for the help of God, or take Jesus up on his promise, help me in this moment, speak words of peace and comfort. And he'll answer those prayers. It's a very powerful exercise, really, if you ever get in that position. And I feel like, you know, what else do you have when something like that happens? What else have you got? You've got your faith in God. It's the only thing that stands between any of us in disaster, in my opinion. So we have another caller. Shall we take a caller, guys?
Yes.
Sure.
Hi, am I on air?
Yeah, hi, Lee.
Oh, hi. Yeah, this is Lee in the Kansas City area. And I just wanted to share an experience I had with interfaith dialogue that happened serendipitously. And as I was thinking about the story, one of the Urantia book quotations which came to mind was the idea that Jesus knew when he, or Michael knew when he came to earth, that the darkness of our situation would illuminate the Father's glory even more brightly. And so it was a good chance for him to reveal the Father, you know, due to our darkness. And so that sort of applies to my story, because this happened when I still lived in Northern California, and I was going out with someone, but it wasn't a very healthy relationship. And we weren't really getting along, but we went to a party that was held at the house of one of his friends, and so he knew those people, but I didn't, and we weren't really getting along very well, so we didn't spend time at the party together. So that left me, like, there with all those people I didn't know. But because it was in Northern California, and it was a more metropolitan area, the people at the party were just a wonderful, wonderful intercultural mixture. And so I saw a woman from India who was sitting on the floor, and she had a smudge on her forehead. And I thought, you know, I sort of remembered, you know, what the Urantia book says about learning the best, you know, of every religion from others. And I thought, well, okay, I guess I'll talk to her, because I was like very uncomfortable at that party, and I didn't really like being there. So I sat down by her, and I don't remember exactly, but I think I probably asked her about, you know, the smudge on her forehead and what that represented. And then that led from, you know, one thing to another. And I told her that I was also a person of faith, and I told her what I appreciated about my experience of prayer, and I asked her if she had had similar experiences, because, you know, I figured that probably would be a common ground. And boy, her face just illuminated right away, and she started talking, and I don't remember what we said, but I remember how palpable our connection was. And my serendipitous experience with her was the bright light of that party that I wouldn't have had if, you know, if the party hadn't been so dismal. I don't think I ever would have, you know, approached her, but I approached her because I was like desperate for somebody to connect to. And I thought she offered a pretty good chance because of that smudge on her forehead. So, but it turned out to be, you know, just a very uplifting experience. And my voice still kind of, you know, chokes up when I think about it, because it was a treasure within that party that I almost missed.
Wow.
I like that. It was a treasure in that party I almost missed. I always like to grab a hold of something that's cool.
Well, and that reminds me of Jesus saying, lay up your treasures in heaven. Because for me, obviously, our treasures have to be the things we get to take with us. And those memories, those experiences, and especially relationships, obviously, are treasures. Those we get to keep. And those are the moments of victory, you know.
Yeah, but, and I'm sorry, and I just wanted to add one more thing, and then I'll probably just hang up. But the thing I wanted to add was that I, you know, have stumbled across people here and there where we've engaged in interfaith dialogue. Like maybe I'm, you know, standing in a really long line at the DMV or something like that, and so I just chat with them, and we have a chance to chat. And one of my little sort of guidelines is whenever they want to get into, like, belief, which is to me a little bit of a dangerous area, I try to, like, very gently and unobtrusively steer it back to, you know, universal spiritual matters that would be a reality to anybody regardless of their beliefs if they really did have a relationship with God. And that usually works out pretty well because if someone doesn't want to go there, then I really don't want to argue with them. So that's a good thing for me to know, that it's better than to turn to chit-chat to the weather instead of talking about faith, because I just don't want to argue about beliefs.
Yeah, I think that's a really good practice.
Cannot argue about, you think about this, if you get into arguing about beliefs, who's going to win?
Exactly.
There's something I started saying a long time ago that just popped up one day when it got very, very, very difficult in an interfaith meeting. I said, you know what? If we're all right in what we believe, then that means we're all wrong.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And interesting, the one person that, as an interfaith council, that we had to unceremoniously let go. And your Rashput Rooters know that that's what they did at the Ermia lectures, right?
Right.
Was an atheist. We were allowing an atheist to sit on the board because he wanted to give his viewpoint, you know, which I thought was interesting that he wanted to be on an interfaith council.
Hmm.
Like atheism is a faith.
Right. So and that's where I
have
came to. Well, he has faith in not believing. So, but we rotate sharing our religious our understanding of reality with each other. You know, every month somebody does this, and there are guidelines. Well, when he shared, he was doing a great job as far as me understanding atheism. What does that mean? But then he made a direct attack on this group of people. He said, he was talking about the concept of the Trinity, you know, and of course how bogus that is, and how that's bogus for other religions and da-da-da-da-da. Then he said, but we're still not to the truth yet. We're getting closer. Realize when people realize there is no God, then you'll know the truth. Now, he said that to a group of very seasoned interfaith people. And can you imagine him saying that? And I was so proud of that 30-something people. Nobody stood up and, you know, you would think. But he was unceremonious. I can't say that word right now.
Unceremoniously.
Unceremoniously dismissed. Because where was that going to go? That was a direct attack on the whole system. And you know, there's a quote that's on my, when you walk up to my kitchen sink, it was handwritten for me by someone in calligraphy. And it says, let me find it in my mind right now. I'm having a moment here myself. Because I'm concerned about Kevin being, Paula, I'm not as good as multitasking as you are. That is Kevin, was he, you're reading
he got,
about that.
I guess he got kicked off the chat board for saying LOL too much.
That's what he said.
Yeah, I've never heard of such a thing. That's
yeah, I was gonna, yeah, we need to get talk to them about that. Okay, here's the quote. Lord, make my words soft and tender today, for tomorrow I may have to eat them.
Oh. Wow,
that's right over my kitchen sink.
Make my words soft and tender today, because tomorrow I may have to eat them.
Yep.
Now that, to me, that's humility. That's understanding, and Ann and I have had a chance to have a lot of conversations about this kind of thing, and she told me once, and Ann, this is something I always remember, you said, I often pray, Father, put a guard on my tongue. And that's been a problem for me all my life, because I'm I'm an extrovert and I'm a very verbal person, and it's so easy to say the exact wrong thing. And ever since you told me that, it's been a constant prayer of mine. Put a guard on my tongue. Don't let me say anything, because the last thing on earth I ever want to do is hurt anybody. That's not who I am. And that has really helped me, and to know that you can pray to the Father, and He's done it too. You know, I got to hand it to Him.
Yeah, be careful what you ask for, because that has actually happened to me. After I started praying that little simple prayer, I'd be talking to our kids, and I'd start feeling it rise up in me, getting upset with one of the kids, and I'd literally be talking it, and I'd go, I'd stammer, I couldn't even get words out. And I realized, I literally meant that prayer, apparently.
Yeah, I often just give the Heavenly Father a blanket permission.
Yeah.
Say, I give you permission to stop me by any means if I'm going to say something that will harm somebody, hurt, and especially hurt their self-respect or their self-esteem or their ability to, because I think often my philosophy is that the world is hard enough, and we all want to do, most people want to do the right thing, and our little judgments and our criticisms, it does more to thwart people from acting in any respect, and obviously we're not perfect, we're going to do the wrong thing, and we have to learn these lessons oftentimes the hard way, but if we're paralyzed with fear, we can't act for fear of doing the wrong thing, because others are so critical of our actions, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Consequences often are too severe, they're too severe, we're so severe with each other, I wish we'd lighten up sometimes and just realize that the only way we're going to get good at interfaith or dialogue or outreach or whatever it is we've decided to do in this world is just by doing it, by trying. It's like our friend Chris Halverson says, God
say
can't drive
again, Paula.
A car.
Would you say that again, please? I like what you just said.
The only way we're going to get good at doing whatever it is we decide to do in this life is by just doing it.
Trying
yeah. it.
Yeah. And look, Kevin got back in the board because he kept trying.
See, there you go, Kevin.
I wanted to add to that when you're done with what you were saying.
No, go ahead, honey.
Okay. Well, that is a very big theme of mine that you just mentioned, and that, the need to be supportive of one another. And I take that directly from the Arantia book, because the Arantia book says in more than one place that how we do what we do matters just as much as what we do. And if that were not true, we wouldn't need to have, religion. We could just be achievers who got what we got, whatever way we got it. But
right.
but the spirit is all about how things are done. And in terms of honoring the dignity and the respect of other creatures of the Father. And so that's such a strong theme in the book. But what counters that theme for me is our culture, because, in the United States, and I don't know about other countries, but I know in the United States for sure we are a product-oriented culture, which is get it done now, and get it done well. But how you get it done in terms of respecting and honoring other people and allowing their creative process, that's totally goes by the wayside because it's all money-dominated. So I think a lot of that culture filters over into, you know, we who are acculturated by that influence. And it just astonishes me and flabbergasts me so often when people, you know, that I know the Urantia Book 100 times better than I do and can cite page numbers for their quotations from memory, still treat one another in ways that dishonor them. And they justify it by saying, well, that product, that thing we're trying to produce, that's what matters. But no, how you treat another matters just as much. And the final thing I want to say about that is that my take on God the Father is that the Father is all about relationships. That's totally
right.
What he's about. The first thing he did was he made a relationship with himself, you know, by forming the Trinity. And then from that, all the other relationships unfolded. So if you don't honor relationships, like, you're not getting the message of the book.
Right. Here, Lee, I have to commend you on that comment, because I really think that that is the most important thing. And the way we learn to have a relationship with God is also influenced by how we learn to have relationships with each other.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And the level of patience and tolerance that we have for each other really is a function of relationship and how you feel about that person. And you can choose love. You can choose tolerance quite easily.
Okay, what do we do, though? What do we do? And you know you're going to have to go back into a situation where there's one or two or three people that just irritate you. And you know what I'm saying? And how do we deal with that? How do we deal
with irritation? Irritation is sort of another side of anger. It's sort of the less obstreperous side of anger. It's sort of the beginning of anger. And impatience and irritation is all sort of part of that same place. And it is actually indicative of spiritual immaturity. But we have so much animal electrical inheritance, you know, that sometimes we can't control our feelings.
Right. We can control our reactions to those feelings. I'm paraphrasing that, right?
Right.
How we respond.
What?
How we respond.
Right.
So when we have those kinds of feelings, I think we can pray instantly for relief, you know, from that.
Well, and I wanted to add a practical thing. I'm sorry I'm interrupting, Crystal. I'll wait till you. Well, boundaries. It's, you know, that's one of my biggest discoveries of midlife is if I don't have boundaries, then forget it, because I'm going to continually allow myself to be beat up or hurt or, you know, whatever. But if I just have boundaries in terms of, you know, this is the story Paul had just told about the woman who is interrupted while doing meditation. She stated her boundary to the guy who broke into her house, which is my boundary. You know, that's my boundary. You can hurt my body, but I know you can't hurt my spirit. And so she, you know, just by having a boundary and being clear on it, she kept herself safe. And I mean, so for us, I can't really give an example, but if there are people who are irritating you, like you said, Anne, probably it's because, well, I'll say for myself, for me, it's usually because I haven't stated my boundaries. And so I just continue to be irritated and irritated because I haven't said to them, you know, I feel disrespected right now, or I feel like this is not the reason we gathered, or whatever it is that I need to say, so that it can get back to a grounding where we both are treated, you know, with dignity.
Well, you know, one thing,
I think it also has to do with expectation.
Yes, and I have a strong memory of something right now, of making a determined decision. When our daughters were teenagers, I got very upset at my husband one day about the way he was dealing with them versus me. Now, I'm sure nobody else has ever done that. And
no.
No, never.
And there's when I went to bed that night, I carried that with me.
Mm.
And it reminded me of some of my bloodline, you know, that carrying that anger with me. And I was lying there, and I was like, well, that feels kind of good in an odd way. I can literally remember this sensation. And I woke up in the night, and it was still there. And it was there. And then I said, okay, I can't live like this. I don't want that side of me to enjoy this so much that I keep buying into it. And then a Bible scripture actually popped into my head. Don't let the sun go down on your wrath. And it had deep meaning for me in that moment.
Here's a good one from Lou on the board, you guys, for this very topic. He says, this is a quote from the Urantia book. He says, the best way, quoting directly, if you truly desire to overcome the habit of criticizing some friend, the quickest and surest way of achieving such a change of attitude is to establish the habit of praying for that person every day of your life. Isn't that an amazing... I mean, how many people do that when you really have somebody that's irritating you and you don't understand them? And this is the essence of loving your enemy, isn't it? I mean, this is the essence of Jesus' teachings, to love your enemy.
Now, I want to make a point. Ellen is bringing up a good point on the board. My husband is a very good person and a loving father. We were just disagreeing on, you know, certain things. If you're in a situation that is abusive, of course, that's totally different.
Where somebody's abusing children or whatever, you got to stand up big on that one. But
and Lee, congratulations, yeah. Lee, you're multitasking. Aren't we great? I just see Lee writing.
speaking of multitasking, since we're having such a great hen party here, you guys, we have another caller, so hold on.
Oh, but well, Paula, let me hang up and say thank you. God bless you, everyone.
Oh, God bless you. Thanks for calling me.
Late. Okay, bye.
Bye.
Hello?
541, you're on Block Talk.
Hey, how's it going, guys?
Oh, we have a guy.
This is a great show. I just want to say it just filled me with a lot of encouragement. I'm pretty new, I'd say a few months into Block Talk, and the thing that I'm kind of coming across and trying to work out is I'm very passionate about God, Jesus, and my faith, and, you know, I go to these spiritual rooms, they call them open mind rooms, and everything's open mind, you know, open-minded, and they're there for peace and love, but then when I try to explain my side, I just get attacked or ridiculed as, you know, the old dogma. What's the best way to, you know, I'm trying to have an open, loving heart to talk to these people because I really believe that's, you know, what I'm here to do. But it's real easy to get worked up, I guess, you know, to be passionate. What's the medium, middle way there?
I want to ask a question.
Hold on. Before you go on, caller, some of the people on our board are asking for your name and your city, if you're willing to give us that.
Oh, it's I'm Genetics on the boards there, and I'm in Oregon.
Okay, hi.
Ontario, Oregon.
Oh, great. Okay, well, Anne, did you have a response to that, or Crystalline?
I have a question. Genetics.
Sure.
I love that. Did you say Genetics?
Yeah, Genetics.
Yeah, that's a cool screen name. Now, what type, these people, there is in a, they claim to be open-minded, is that what you were saying?
Well, exactly. You know, what I do is I try to go where there are people that, you know, believe in this New Age lie, where the aliens, you know, the next step of evolution and whatnot, and I try to intercede and just kind of show them my side of the story. I also have a buddy of mine that works for CE4 research, MUFON research, which is a ufology and the study of UFOs. And he has many, 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 like over 300 cases of you know, these attacks from which I believe is a spiritual interdimensional realm. It's not necessarily an alien attack, but they have been proven to be fought off in the name of Jesus. And, you know, this story is just being hidden because the world view and everything, you know, sci-fi is going towards that, you know, that we are going to be enlightened. I mean, you look at most of the shows today, and at the end of it, the alien is the one, you know, doing all the stuff. It's like they're trying to convince us that that is our creator. And the I don't know if you guys are familiar with the 2012 movement, but, you know, I stand firm on God decides the end of the world. And, you know, to believe in this new age type of thinking is the world's downfall, because they've turned themselves against God, our creator, and they want to be gods themselves.
Well, you know, you've obviously said a lot about some new age thinking. And there's a whole movement of UFOs, and I think, you know, again, getting back to what we were saying earlier and the technique of Jesus of building on the positive in that, I personally believe that there are other inhabited worlds, and I would build on that. I'd say, well, you know, yes, there are other inhabited worlds. I really believe that. I know that.
I'd like to see proof. See, that's their side of the view too. And then they also say, well, there's no God. Well, how can you say that there are other worlds and UFOs when you have literally no proof whatsoever? And I know the top pros, they don't have any proof, and they will say we have no proof, but yet when it comes to my belief, oh, you have no proof either. Well, then can we at least meet in the middle and say, okay, well, you know, there's obviously a creator. If you look in creation all around you, it's, you'd be stupid not to say so, in the smallest molecules, leaves, you know, whatever. But I just would say, okay, well, where's your proof? You know, put it on the table here, because
well,
it can
right
go
there,
both
so,
ways.
See, right there, I was going to say, you're getting into the proving area now, and that's, no one's going to win, because...
Exactly, that's where my dilemma is, you know, I'm just coming as a human here saying, you know, I personally, from my faith, I'm saved with the blood of Jesus, and if... You know, if somebody disagrees on that, that's fine. They don't have to believe that. But then again, don't tell me that we're from planet Zeon when you have no proof. It's not credible. So, I mean, at least...
And even if, I guess the point of interfaith dialogue, I guess you could come from the point of view, really believe this. For whatever reason, do we want to judge them about that? Do we want to prove them wrong?
No, exactly not.
No, we don't. We just want to add to something of value to whatever it is they're believing. And I think you touched on it when you first started to speak. You said, I believe God holds all of these consequences, or I believe that this is in God's hands. You know, we've gone to these expos many times where, you know, there's all kinds of New Agers. And a lot of times you get the doom and gloom prophecies, the 2012, the world's coming to an end, oh, what shall we do? And
yeah.
And we've had them come down to our booth and say, I was just up in a talk by somebody or other, and they said that, you know, everything is going to turn on its head, and the polar, you know, the poles are going to
reverse. Oh, sure, the shift and the alignment, and yeah.
It's so horrible, all that's going to happen. And I've literally had them tell me, please tell me something good, so that I can have hope again.
And that's the love and mercy of our God. I don't believe God would just do that to us. And I guess I guess I'm on the defensive in trying to tell you how I'm being attacked, because these rooms, and when I go in there, I'm not trying to convince anybody. These rooms are called, you know, speak your mind, speak your side of it, and that's when I go to do that.
Then
you know, I guess what's that?
I'd like to say something really, really briefly in response to your dilemma.
We're almost out of time.
When you're,
yeah.
Oh, we are. Well, when you were describing it to us, the tone in which you describe what they think is that you think what they think is stupid, and it's like they have no proof, and there's absolutely no reason for them to believe what they do. And my advice to you is you just have to change your attitude towards them. You can't control what they do to you, and you never will be able to control how other people treat you. But you can control how you treat them. And if you treat them with respect and like you are interested in hearing what they have to say, regardless of whether you think it's ridiculous, you know, you will learn something about their motives and their sentiments, why they feel what they feel, why they believe what they believe. And if your real intention is to learn from them as opposed to try to teach them what you think, you will have a much more successful interfaith dialogue.
Absolutely.
And you will, it
and
might
that
open
is
the door.
Jesus, that is how Jesus did it. He did that very thing that Chris Lynn just described. And that is how he won people over, and he was able to teach them something of value that they could keep. Whether he was not interested in taking things away from people, only building on the truth that they already had. And so it takes a lot of discernment to find the truth there. It may be a totally, you may have a really hard time finding truth in what they're saying, but find the truth. The truth is not necessarily fact. You're talking about two different things. You can prove facts. I can't prove God exists, but I know he does, and that's truth.
I want to end on this note,
Paula,
and I'll interject because we're ending up. The great Beatitudes, to me, speak reams about a living philosophy, genetics, the great Beatitudes spoken by Jesus. And I know we can all agree on that as far as our understanding of how Jesus meant for us to try to walk this path as we live. And we look forward to hearing from you more on the board.
I appreciate you guys taking my phone call, and blessings to you guys. I'm just trying to push love, you know, and I guess you're right. I need to see their sides and why they do believe in that, and, you know, come to a middle ground and say, hey, we're all here. We gotta work together.
There you go.
And they're much more likely to be open to your opinion and your ideas when they know that you really care about theirs.
Certainly. And it's I feel sometimes that, you know, candy coating it and sometimes, I don't know, I guess just as a man and just being stubborn, you know, I could admit that. I could admit that. I just like to, you know, hit the core there. But I guess if they're not ready for it, then if anything, it's just going to turn them away. So I appreciate the phone call, and I'll see you on the boards.
All right. God bless.
Thank you. God bless you.
Well you guys, that is down to 2 minutes.
Yes. Yeah, I was going to bring up the Beatitudes earlier because those are so solid to use in dialogue and as far as seeking common ground and the golden rule.
And I want to share a quote from the book that I've wanted to share for the whole show. And Ann, you said there's two inspiring quotes from the Urantia book on interfaith that just totally inspire you to keep up with your interfaith dialogue. And this is one of my favorites. It's from Paper 92, Section 7, The Further Evolution of Religion. The paper is The Later Evolution of Religion, and this is from Section 7, The Further Evolution of Religion. And I know those of you on the board that read the Urantia book are very familiar with this quote, but it bears some reading, I think. It says, the many religions of Urantia, as we know that means earth, so the many religions of Urantia are all good to the extent that they bring man to God and bring the realization of the Father to man. It is a fallacy for any group of religionists to conceive of their creed as the truth. Such attitudes bespeak more of theological arrogance than of certainty of faith. There is not a Urantia religion that could not profitably study and assimilate the best of the truths contained in every other faith, for all contain truth. Religionists would do better to borrow the best of their neighbor's living spiritual faith rather than to denounce the worst in their lingering superstitions and outworn rituals.
That's been my marching orders as far as that's 10-12 in the old book, that's page 10-12, I believe, right?
Those are your marching orders.
Yes.
And we're down to 40 seconds, friends, so a great show. I want to thank our callers. Thank you, Chrislyn. Thank you, Ann, for sharing with us today.
Thank you. I enjoyed it. I hope everybody on the board enjoyed it. Hello. And I'm glad that Kevin got back in.
Yeah. Thanks to all of you. It's always a pleasure.
Bye, everybody. Bye, Paul.
God bless you.
Love you dearly. Bye.
Love you, too. Bye for now, dear friends.
You've been listening to The Cosmic Citizen, a radio program focused primarily on the study and discussion of the Urantia Book and its teachings. The Urantia Book is a religious text that claims to be written by angels and other superhuman personalities. If you are a Urantia Book reader or a spiritual seeker looking for new truth, we hope and pray you have been nourished and edified by our ministry. Please remember that the views expressed on this